Open March 21st, 2005, and I'd like to start with Senate Bill 820. Mary Nolan, will you come up first? And should we bring Carol Robinson up with you?
That would be great. Thanks, Madam Chair.
Carol, can you join Mary Nolan?
Madam Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, thank you. I'm Mary Nolan. I'm a state representative for Southwest Portland. And I want to thank you for the attention that you're giving to this bill. I understand it has some challenges as it is before you, and that's why I particularly want to thank you for initiating a conversation. Madam Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, this bill is a vehicle for provoking a conversation within the legislature about what we can do to help increase the participation of businesses around the state in helping reduce the number of dependent children who are going without health insurance. As you'll hear a little bit from some other people who will testify this morning, we have seen in our state, as in other states across the country, a very disturbing trend in recent years where the proportion of dependent children of working parents who have access to health insurance has been declining in recent years. As employers have sought ways to manage their businesses and control their expenses, they have been reducing their willingness to provide access to health insurance for the children of their employees. This bill before you was written in a way to start a conversation asking the legislature, healthcare providers, health insurance companies, and employers in the state to find a way to reverse that trend so that we can instead be expanding the coverage for health insurance for these children instead of shrinking it. We know the bill needs work, but I commend you for hearing it today and offer to work with you in any way that would be productive in finding a solution that can bring employers and healthcare providers together to address this problem. Thank you.
Thank you. Carol.
Good afternoon, Chair Mona Sanderson and Vice Chair Cruz. Thank you very much for hearing our input on this. I'm Carol Robinson with the Oregon Business Association. The reason why we've decided to come in here today and talk about Senate Bill 820 is because as an employer organization, we do understand the need to really have some dialogue around these issues. The transferred costs of uninsured, whether they be children or adults, is staggering and putting a large strain on our society as a whole. And yet, as I've done some cursory research in my organization about what kinds of increases the employers that belong to OBA are like, it's close to 20% right now increased health insurance costs. So you can see the need on both sides to have a clear discussion. Oregon Business Association, our health care committee, and our board of directors would very much like to be part of a discussion, a part of a work group to look at Senate Bill 820, look at if there's something that can be forged that would be able to really better protect children, dependent children in Oregon with health insurance, and also be done in a way that is affordable and perhaps incentivized to businesses across the state as well. And so we'd just like to be on record as we'd like to be a part of that discussion as it continues ongoing.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. Beth Ketch. Did I say it right?
Yes. Good afternoon, Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Beth Capsch. I am the Policy Associate at Children First for Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. Children First for Oregon is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization dedicated to protecting and strengthening the health and well-being of Oregon's children and families. We work to inform decision makers, the media, and the general public about issues impacting children and offer solutions that constitute sound policy choices and smart investments. We commend Senator Bates for sponsoring Senate Bill 820, and we thank you, Mrs. Chair, for hearing the bill today. Senate Bill 820 seeks to address a very pressing issue facing Oregon, and that's the increasing number of children without health insurance in our state. This past September, when we issued our annual report card on the status of children, the overall grade was a D+. This is the lowest statewide grade received since we began the annual review of child well-being in 1992. In the health category of the report card, the grade was an alarming D-, and one of the factors driving this grade was the rising rate of uninsured children. Oregon can and should do more to make sure every child has access to quality health care. We know that healthy kids learn better and are much more likely to grow up to be successful adults. Research tells us that a child with health insurance is much more likely to receive preventative care and treatment for illnesses. Conversely, children without health insurance are more likely to suffer from earaches, sore throats, and asthma, common childhood illnesses that force students to miss school and hamper their educational success. In addition, a child without health insurance can put a significant financial strain on a family if that child becomes ill or injured. Currently in Oregon, more than 100,000 children do not have health insurance on any given day. This sad statistic is made even sadder by the knowledge that Oregon was making progress, but now is losing ground. In 1994, prior to the Oregon Health Plan and the State Children's Health Insurance Program, the percentage of uninsured children stood at 14%. With a strong economy and smart investments like the Oregon Health Plan, that the uninsurance rate dropped to as low as 10% in the late 1990s. Now, however, several factors are driving that rate back up to above 12%. These factors include cuts in publicly funded coverage, fewer employers providing dependent coverage for their employees, and the rising cost of family coverage that puts insurance out of the reach of many working parents. With more children living in Oregon, we now have more uninsured children than ever before. Now is the time to put Oregon back on track when it comes to making sure every child has access to health care. Again, we commend this committee and the sponsor of Senate Bill 820 for working to address this critical problem facing our state. Children First is ready and willing to be a resource on this issue, and we would be happy to commit time and energy to continuing this conversation about how to take action this legislative session to ensure more children. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Bruce Goldberg.
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, Bruce Goldberg, Administrator of the Oregon Office for Health Policy and Research. I'm here just to make a couple of very brief comments to you about Senate Bill 820, really to, in many ways, echo some of the testimony that you've just heard. What we know is that the number of children without health insurance in this state is increasing. We had 7-8% of the children in the state were uninsured in 1996-1998, and that has progressively increased. In the year 2000, 8.5% of children were uninsured. In the year 2002, 10% of children. And in 2004, 12.3%. And I think the point in all of that is that we have seen the number of children without health insurance increase in this state, actually at a time when we have maintained public coverage for children in the Oregon Health Plan and in our Medicaid and CHIP programs. We have not seen the kind of cuts in those programs as we have in such programs as OHP Standard. So at a time when we continued to maintain public coverage coverage and even increase public coverage for children, we've seen the number of children without health insurance in the state increase. I'm not going to speak directly to the bill at hand, but just to really echo the fact that, indeed, it's a problem when over 1 in 10 children in this state are without access to basic health care. And a number of us who are involved in operationalizing many of the state's policies, myself, Barney Spate from OMAP and Rocky King from FEOP, we all would very much like to be involved in any kind of work group and to participate in the kind of process that would bring a solution to really what is a tragedy for our state, which is that children don't have access to basic health care.
Thank you. I'll call Ellen Penny and Angela Kimball up, the last two. Just for your information, I will be assigning a work group after this for, we will not be work sessioning it.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Angela Kimball, and I'm here representing the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs. I'll be brief. The association strongly supports this bill. We see more and more children who are uninsured falling into the community mental health safety net, but as you are well aware, the funding for such a safety net has been steadily decreasing while the numbers of individuals, especially children, needing services has been increasing. Anything that can help children be insured and families will help earlier intervention, and we believe be a more cost-effective and healthier and more productive way to treat the mental health issues and other issues that affect children and families.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Owen Penny. I work with the Oregon Health Action Campaign, and we have long supported using any method we can to draw down the federal CHIP dollars that are available to Oregon. We were dismayed to learn that Oregon lost some $29 million in CHIP funding because we did not use it. Funding children using children's health insurance program dollars is an enormous bang for Oregon's buck. We get 72 or 73 cents for every 28 we put in. We support this bill not only for that reason, but because the majority of Oregon's uninsured are workers, and the majority of Oregon's employers offer health insurance. Requiring employers to contribute in some way to health care for the uninsured both levels the playing field for Oregon employers and is a creative way to expand access. My only comment would be that if we are going to use CHIP dollars to provide access to more children, we should also offer the Oregon Health Plan not only the purchase of private insurance as an option, and we would like to see that the Insurance Pool Governing Board, in fact, be required to look at both options as vehicles for covering Oregon's uninsured children. Thank you.
Thank you. Members, we're not going to move this. I'm not sure when we will reschedule it, but I would like to appoint a subgroup to work on this, and I would like Representative Nolan, and there I'd like to have a couple of senators and another representative such as Billy Dalto, Al Bates, Ben Wesson, but I want to check with them first to see if they would be on it. But I'd also like Aaron Kelly Seal, Bruce Goldberg, Lynn Lundquist, Rocky King, Tina Kotek, and John Powell to be part of this committee and work on it. Rick, will you help facilitate that thing? All right.
Thank you.
All right.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Just a comment on the record. I find it interesting. Yes, we are seeing dependents losing health insurance because people can no longer afford it. And yet we continue to do more mandates. And this bill isn't a formula for a discussion. This is a mandate. It's pure and simple. And so our solution is we're going to assess businesses and employees to pay for something they can't afford. This is problematic.
Well, I hopefully the subcommittee will be innovative and take Senator Cruz's... Yeah, it's a work group. Yeah, sorry. Yeah,
I think you ought to be on the committee.
Okay, with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 820, and I would like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 855. And Mr. Bacovian, should I have opened both of these, or just one at a time? Okay.
That's a good way to go.
Until they walk out.
Okay, that's true.
We might want to have
that does become a problem from time to time.
Well,
Michael Mason and Justin, do you want to be the first? No. Okay.
We can wait.
Linda, but you're the only proponent, so I want you.
There was nobody else. So
yeah, so it had to be me. This is an unusual position for me to be in, and I apologize for the committee having to just bear with me and not with Louis Pitt, who is usually here to testify. As you can see, that normally leaves me free to hand over the testimony. But Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, very much appreciate you scheduling this bill and hearing testimony from us today. This is.
Please state your name.
Oh, thank you. Michael Mason. I lobby for the Confederated Tribes of the Warm Springs and live in Portland. I'm presenting testimony for Louis Pitt, the Director of Government Affairs and Planning for the Confederated Tribes of the Warm Springs, who is urging your support of Senate Bill 855, which is a modest bill that would simply allow tribes to act as local health authorities for the limited purpose of obtaining funding for parent and child health programs, or as they call the program, maternal child health on the reservation. Of course, the health of the children of the Confederated Tribes of the Warm Springs is of critical importance. And they already have a clinic, which they built with tribal funds. They did not wait for the federal government to come up with the money, because that would have taken decades. And the health services there are primarily funded by the Indian Health Service. But it is sorely inadequate funding. There is not even a budget item for maternal child health under the Indian Health Service. And they only provide less than half of the as much money for health care for Indians per capita as they do for other Americans. So at the same time, the tribes account for over a quarter of the births in Jefferson County, which is where Warm Springs is located. And I'm not going to go through all the data here, the narrative, but I think I would just direct you to the chart on the final page, which just shows some effectiveness on their program's part in reducing teen pregnancy. I should say sharply reducing teen pregnancy.
Sure.
So they do have an effective program despite the lack of funds, and it would be important to provide to them the opportunity to have funding, primarily federal, for parent and child health that now does not go to serve the tribal members. So I'd be happy to answer questions.
Senator Frank Shields is here. Why don't we have him come at this point? You can stay there.
In case you've got questions, you need Michael to stay here. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm being pulled out of the same committee three times, possibly, in this hearing of yours this afternoon, so I get to run from one end of the building to another.
Do you have your pedometer on?
I got my pedometer on, yes. For the record, my name is Frank Shields. I represent Senate District 24, which many of you probably don't know is in juxtaposition to Senator Monis Anderson's district. We share a lot of common border there. I sponsored Senate Bill 855 because I believe it is the best way our state can serve our people in rural areas. The best way is to work closely with Indian tribes to address these important issues. No issue is more important than adequate health care for infants, pregnant women, and new moms. For decades now, this body has worked to improve our relationship with the Indian people of Oregon. That good work has strengthened the tribes and their neighbors since I joined the Assembly 13 years ago. A critical part of our work with Senate Bill 770, which codified the government-to-government relationship which exists between agencies and the tribes. This bill has led to increased cooperation between agencies and last session to a bill providing for funding to tribes that had only gone to counties and transit districts before. Senate Bill 180 for tribal access to special transportation fund was ODOT's thoughtful response to our mandate in Senate Bill 770. Now, Senate Bill 855 is a similar solution that will allow tribes the capacity to provide maternal child health services directly access the dollars. And I heard Michael saying this as I came in, these are primarily federal dollars. And to help them care for their infants, those with children, and new moms. This should be an obvious choice at a time when both parties and the governor have declared this care to be their highest health priority. Tribes like the Warm Springs have clinics where they are providing these services despite the fact that the federal government does not spend half as much for Indian health care per capita as it does for other Americans. Passing Senate Bill 855 is the least we can do to help fill the gap. We should provide capable tribes with funding as we do the counties. We can do this without reducing the funding that the counties receive, and I will work to see that we achieve this. I just wanted to come and urge your support of the bill.
Thank you. Yes, Senator Cruz.
Question, probably not for the senator.
The guy that knows something.
Yeah. I guess my question would be, in the case of, for example, the Cow Creeks that do have a clinic, Warm Springs is kind of has boundaries where like Cow Creeks truly don't necessarily have boundaries, and their clinic currently is for tribal members and employees of the tribe. And I'm just wondering how you envision the nexus between that and the other clinics in the community, because clearly there'd have to be some sort of nexus.
Well, now, in talking with Chair and Monis Anderson and members of the committee and Senator Cruz, in talking with DHS officials about this, they have certain requirements that you must meet in order to act as a local health authority. As I understand it, every tribe would have to come forward and show that they demonstrate that they met those requirements. I believe that Warm Springs is already in that position. There are reporting requirements that the Indian and very strict requirements for use of the funds that the Indian Health Service requires. I doubt seriously that DHS's are more stringent than those of the Indian Health Service. But I think that would be incumbent on each tribe to demonstrate their capability. And then there's a review period, as I understand it, at least every 3 years once things got going or once funding was provided.
Okay, I guess, Madam Chair, my concern was to make sure that compatibility happened with what already exists in a community where the populations are going to be blended. And I mean, I think that's something that maybe DHS can answer that. I'm not sure, but we don't want to fragment the system. I mean, certainly this expansion I think is appropriate. I just want to make sure it's done in a connected way.
Any other questions? Thank you. Justin Martin and Cheryl Kennedy.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Justin Martin, and I'm here today on behalf of the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde, where I'm also a tribal member. And I'm very pleased to have with me a true expert, not only in the fact that she is our current tribal chair, but also the original director of the Health and Wellness Center, and really helped us get off the ground with respect to the clinic. I know we wanted to speak on both bills today. How should we do that, Madam Chair?
Um, Should I just go home?
We should close this and then you have something to declare on the record.
Okay.
So you can go through this one as well.
Yeah, I'd rather speak to this and then bring up DHS and then just to keep it clean.
Excellent.
Do you mind? Yeah.
Thank you very much. We were going to propose that we could hang around and be able to wrap up some of the questions from after hearing some other testimony on the other bill. So with that, I'd like to introduce you again to Cheryl Kennedy, the tribal chairperson from the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde.
Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here. We're here to speak in support of this bill.
Please state your name for the record.
My name is Cheryl Kennedy. I'm the chair of the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde. What I want to do here is to provide a little history in terms of the predicament that we're in today. Back in 1953, the federal government provided services up until then under the Department of War for Native American Indians. Back in 1953, a new agency was created. It was called the Indian Health Service. The Indian Health Service then set up hospital and clinics throughout the United States for the tribes who they had a responsibility for in terms of all of the treaties that were embarked upon in the 1800s. For Oregon, the clinics and the hospitals were in Warm Springs, Oregon. There was one here in Salem, the Chemawa Health Center. There was also a hospital there. And there was also one for the Umatilla tribes. All other tribes had to travel to those clinics to receive care. Or in some cases, there were physicians who were contracted out. For us, our doctor lived here in Salem. Her name was Dr. Ruth Jens. She was a psychiatrist. And she traveled down through the various Western Oregon communities for Native Americans by boat, by horseback, whatever means that she had. She was a very wonderful woman who I had the privilege to meet when I came to become the health administrator for the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde. I was hired as one of the first three employees of the tribe when we were restored back in 1983. For a span of nearly 30 years, the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde had no health care mechanism because we were terminated. At the time, the federal government embarked upon a new way for giving health services to Native Americans. At the same time, the Grand Ronde tribe was terminated. So institutions of healthcare services were developing and came to full fruition for many tribes, but not for tribes who were terminated. That included Siletz and then tribes that were restored. Someone mentioned a little earlier the Cow Creek tribe. They were restored. So were the Coquilles and the Coos and Lower Umpquas. So that's kind of the backdrop for how we come to this situation that we have today. The federal government designated those clinics that they set up through the Indian Health Services as public health agencies, whereby all of the public health approaches and services for women and children were delivered. So that left a big gaping hole. As you can see, there was no service for us. Maternal child health is very important to not only tribal peoples, but to every people. The Native American has the largest infant mortality in the United States, meaning we die more from lack of child care, lack of adequate services for pregnant women. That's further complicated by some of the rural areas by which our reservations and our tribes are located. When I became the health director, I contracted for services that the Indian Health Services, the federal agency, was to provide for our people. The first service we contracted for was for what you call community health representatives and the nursing program. because we felt that these people were the experts who would get the service out to our women and our children. We then put together a full-blown health care delivery system, and I would invite any of you to come out to Grand Ronde to see the beautiful health clinic that was constructed with our own dollars and erected in 1997. We serve a full array of health care services that include primary health care services and ancillary services. All of those because we were able to contract from the federal government the dollars that should have been there to provide our health care. Some of the services that are lacking are primarily in maternal child health because those dollars flow through the state to go to public health departments. Consequently, tribes do not receive those funds. I'm here to say today that we support this bill, that we encourage you to thoroughly consider the request and the disparity that is out there. The question that was asked earlier about how would a tribe serve community members as well as their own tribal members. When we contracted to provide services for our Grand Ronde tribe, we recognized that not only were we going without care, but all of our community was as well. And so in providing our health care delivery services, we do provide services for all of the community. They receive no different care than we do. They are seen by all of our providers. And I will also say this, as far as women, infant, and children, the WIC program, it's primarily a service to deliver a service to at-risk infants and children. There is no public transportation system to Grand Ronde. Our WIC program is located in Dallas or else in McMinnville. There's no public health care transportation system there. The tribe has built over 100 homes since we've been restored there. We are now on the throes of erecting 72 more low-income homes. Those people do not have access to WIC services by neither county because they cannot get there. So I'm here to compel this body to truly consider the lack of services that are out there in rural communities of Oregon, and that includes the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde. And I'm open to questions.
Senator Morissette. Yeah,
thank you. My question, I think I know the answer to the question, but I'll ask it anyway. There are integrated levels of service that the counties provide that tribal members have access to.
Correct, and in this case, they could if they... Most of them are targeted at low-income families,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you need to be able to get there.
Okay. Follow-up?
Yes.
Yeah, and I understand that some tribes, like the Cow Creek Without Boundaries, have greater access to general health care provided by the counties, and other tribes that have more concentrated tribal lands are at a distinct disadvantage in that regard. Is that right?
I cannot comment for the Cow Creeks. I don't know what their where their cluster populations are. So
okay, follow up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've not had an opportunity to really think about this issue before in depth, and I guess I will have a conversation with the county representatives at some point because I as I see the issue, you're requesting state support for health care that is currently lacking as far as the tribe is concerned, or the various tribes, and lacking probably because of the concentration of population in certain areas as opposed
correct.
To other areas.
That's correct.
Yeah, okay. So I understand your concern, and I certainly support your request on this issue.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Why don't you stay there, and we'll call up Linda Fleming. She's the last one to testify. And also, you two are the only ones with Linda for Senate Bill 9672, so we'll just do both of them together, but I haven't opened 967 yet.
Can you have two?
I could. Okay, I'll open a public hearing also on Senate Bill 967 since we're dealing with the same people and all of the presenters are right here.
I'll give my testimony on 967 also. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Linda Fleming, the Executive Director of the Oregon Coalition of Local Health Officials. We represent Oregon's 34 local health departments. The coalition cannot support Senate Bill 855 as it is written. Quite frankly, we probably would not support any bill by local government even that appeared to fragment the public health system or allow local jurisdictions to pick and choose what public health services they wanted to provide or didn't want to provide. So just for that point of clarification. We have encouraged Gary Weeks, strongly encouraged Gary Weeks, to convene meetings between the Department of Human Services, the Oregon Coalition of Local Health Officials, and the affected tribes. We're pleased to say that Gary has agreed to do that, and I believe we have a meeting scheduled next week on March 29th at 3 o'clock here in Salem. So I'm very glad to see that we're going to all be able to come to the table and discuss this important issue. In addition to that, this Wednesday, the 16 impacted counties of these two bills will be also be meeting to talk about the impacts and implications of both of these bills. Public health is a system of protections for a community. Oregon revised statutes specifically identify five essential services that must be provided by the local public health authority. In addition, the Conference of Local Health Officials, in cooperation with the Department of Human Services, within the last 2 years, has adopted the national standards known as the 10 essential functions of public health as the minimum standards for local health departments in Oregon. Assuming authority for one essential service does not comply with current state statute, nor does it comply with the adopted minimum standards for local health departments. And I would like to say that those standards are required in Oregon statute. I believe if you look in ORS 431, you'll see that the local authority was required to develop those minimum standards with the state of Oregon and have them signed off by the Department of Human Services. This bill proposes to give management authority for parent and child health services to the Tribal Council of Federally Recognized Tribes. It's my opinion that they, at least on reservation lands, already have that authority, and what is probably to their benefit at this current time is they're able to self-determine the level of programming that they're going to provide, what types of programs they want to provide, what best meets their needs. While this bill may provide some opportunities both for the tribes and, I might add, for the local health departments, it also provides a scope of authority and responsibility the tribes may not have intended to receive nor be held accountable for. As I said before, they can currently self-determine their level of programming with tribally operated maternal child health programs. By being named the local public health authority for this specific essential services, Oregon revised statutes and administrative rules would become the determinants of program and service elements on tribal lands. There are regulatory functions in the parent and child health rules. They must provide reproductive health services that meet all of the guidelines of Title 10. There are crossovers between communicable disease control, other public health programs, and parent and child health activities. An annual plan must be submitted and approved by the Department of Human Services. They would be subject to a triennial review and compliance with programs standards by the Department of Human Services. These are just to name a few criteria that they may not now be responsible for that we would want to make sure was clearly understood by all entities. And I want to just digress here a little bit and tell you that I have a vested personal and professional interest in Indian populations, especially the Warm Springs tribe. Two of my grandchildren happen to be half Indian, and their father is an enrolled member at Warm Springs. So I have a personal interest in good things happening for Indian children and mothers and families in general. But in addition to that, I worked for almost 20 years directly with the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs. And when I was there, we formed some successful partnerships and approaches to identified needs during my tenure with Jefferson County. I believe opportunities are still there for the tribes that they may not now be taking full advantage of that would better support their program needs than does this bill. Just this morning at 10:30, I visited with Jim Quaid, who is the administrator for Health and Human Services at Warm Springs, and talked to him about what their needs are, and it appears that they have a significant budget deficit in their maternal child health program, especially as it relates to their home visiting. I offered our personal assistance to Jim and his staff on how we might be able to identify ways that they could be accessing federal revenues, particularly in the area of Medicaid funds for services. And I told him I would personally follow through with helping them on that. I've already contacted Catherine Bradley at the Department of Human Services, who has already put in a call to OMAP to get a clear understanding of what current rules are and where there might be opportunities for tribal entities to better participate.
I'd like to cut to the chase here, mm-hmm. and I think it's extremely valuable what Ms. Kennedy says, that I consider children on the reservation Oregonians just like I consider children in Madras or, you know, off the reservation. And I would hope that DHS and the tribes would get together, and if there is a need for WIC services, for maternal child health, that somehow there could be a resolution. You know, I would hate to say, well, because you're reservation, you can't access these. So I think this is a good concept, because I think we need to look at the needs of the children. And if there is a population that, I don't know, satellite clinics or whatever, but I would hope that we would be able to look at it. Senator Cruz.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I guess I see 967 more problematic than 855, but you know, one of the problems in 855 is what it says in the bill is that the tribe becomes the local public health authority, and which is why I brought up the whole concept of the way Cow Creek is structured as a health clinic in a community, and clearly our public health system can use all of the friends they can get, and I think this is positive, and to allow these clinics access to federal funds for this purpose is purely positive, but I see whether or not the Scrivener's error or whatever in there to allow the tribe to usurp the public health authority from another entity, I don't think is what you're after. You just want to be a public health authority for purposes of federal funds. So I think there's some language adjustments we can make that might allow us to get where we need to go here.
Would you like to comment on 967, Linda, if you just stay there?
Sure.
Again, Madam Chair, Justin Martin with the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde. Thank you again for hearing from us today, and I won't take much time because we do have our expert here. But what we wanted to talk to today, and that Cheryl touched on earlier, is the history of Grand Ronde. And specifically our clinic that serves not just Grand Ronde tribal members, but our clinic that serves the entire 35-mile radius, the clinic in which physicians from Sheridan and Willamina, the neighboring towns, have moved their practices to, the clinic that sees everybody. Again, it's not a situation of us versus them. It's a situation of who can provide the service and who can provide the service in the best manner. And I, Madam Chair, I really appreciate your language of, again, at the end of the day, this this is about Oregonians, and this is about providing that service and that opportunity or that option of health care. And again, to be frank, in our situation and in our community, Grand Ronde has been able to deliver those services time and time again, and we have really built a strong sense of community. With that, I'll turn it over to Cheryl.
I'm Cheryl Kennedy with the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde. Truly appreciate yet this time to testify on this bill as well. Some of the, just for the understanding of those who don't work in this field day to day, some of the differences that you look at when you look at a tribal facility, different than a public health agency as we have at Warm Springs. The Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde fully operates its own clinic for the community. It has physician services, it has ancillary services of laboratory, radiology, pharmacy, mental health. Those are the services that we provide for on behalf of all who request the service. One of the things that we lack is, I'll use for example this year, we understood that public health was projecting a flu epidemic. We don't receive the serum. We go through the counties to receive the serum. We were not eligible to get the serum until everyone else had theirs. Is that a fair, equitable way of distributing health care? I say no. If we were identified as our own health authority, we would be in the same level of service and in line to receive those kinds of important immunizations that would protect the community. In the same way, we don't receive any of the services that are provided by Homeland Security. Many of them are looking at chemical warfare and the ability to combat those kind of attacks that might arise. We're not in that position to do that. Again, we are asking for the same level of services that are provided for other communities of this sort. As I described earlier, when the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde was restored, no one knew what might be built in that community. And as we stand today, we have we function as a public health facility, but we are without many of the services that are afforded to those institutions like that. So I'm open to questions.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Again, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Linda Fleming, Executive Director of the Coalition of Oregon Coalition of Local Health Officials, representing Oregon's 34 local health departments. Again, we cannot support Senate Bill 967 at this time without further clarification between the Department of Human Services, the tribes, and our organization. We, as I said, will be meeting next week with Gary Weeks, tribal representatives, to discuss the implications, as well as meeting with our 16 impacted counties this week. We believe it's important to convene these meetings because we think there are issues, I shouldn't say issues, but there's a lot that needs to be clarified. We need to really identify what the implications and impact would be of this proposal for everyone, for the state, for the tribes, and for the local county jurisdictions. We need to clarify where this actual jurisdiction is for the tribal council. Would it be on reservations, tribal reservations? Would it be on property that is off the reservation but owned by the tribal, which the tribal council has authority, or would it be over tribal members regardless of where they live? That's not real clear to us. We also would need to clarify that a tribal local public health authority would be responsible, accountable for the same service elements, program standards, regulatory functions, reporting, planning, etc., as is currently required of the local public health authority. And last but not least, and to be quite frank, as Senator Mona Sanderson said earlier, we need to identify what the fiscal impact is going to be and how are we going to fund additional jurisdictions. Because, you know, public health is a system of protections, as I said before. It's very complex, it's multifaceted, and frankly, in Oregon, it is poorly funded. It's heavily reliant upon federal and local funds. Some of these federal funds are currently available to tribal governments. Local funds that fund a large portion of the system are from county general funds, fees, Medicaid reimbursements, and contracts they might have with school districts or jails or that sort of thing. The state's contribution is less than one-third of what it costs to operate a health department in compliance with the minimum standards for local health departments. With 16 counties potentially impacted by this bill and a potential of 9 tribes accepting local public health authority, we cannot move forward with this proposal without serious consideration of how we fund Oregon's public health system. Diluting funds to an already struggling system isn't in anyone's best interest, the states, the counties, nor the tribes, and I truly believe that that is not the intention of the folks that are sponsoring this bill. I think we all want more money, quite frankly. There are areas of the local public health authority that we're not sure have been carefully reviewed and considered by the requesting tribal authority, and we just want the opportunity to discuss that with them and make sure we all understand what the scope is that they're requesting. I know that we in the Department of Human Services have several unanswered questions. Just a few examples would be in Oregon Revised Statute 431, the local public health authority receives instruction and is under the supervision of the Department of Human Services. Have the impacts and implications of this on self-determination been considered by the state and the tribes? The local public health authority enforces rules adopted by the Department of Human Services and enforces state law adopted by the department under the supervision and direction of the department. Does this add a layer of rules and laws that tribal lands are not currently subjected to? And is there an attempt to waive some of that, establish a different level of level of standards? You know, how would we work through those issues? Also in ORS 431, if a county waives its local public health authority, which one county has waived its local public health authority, the state of Oregon becomes the authority for that county and can contract with another agency or provide the services itself. If only one or two of the eligible tribal councils accept the local public health authority, is the state of Oregon then responsible for the other 7 or 8 as they would be for counties?
Does the tribes pay county taxes?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, in what sense is the question?
Our funds for services, they come from for public health, state funds and county funds. And I was just wondering if the tribes paid into this, into pay taxes.
Madam Chair, my experience when I was in Jefferson County was that if you lived on the reservation, you do not pay county property taxes. The school districts do receive what they refer to as impact aid based upon the number of American students in the school system.
Yeah. Yes, Senator Morissette.
I think I know the answer to this too, but what's the economic base of the Warm Springs tribe? Traditionally, what has been the economic base of the Warm Springs tribe? Timber, fishing, so on.
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, I cannot comment on them.
Do they
Warm Springs tribe?
Do they have their a casino one at the present time?
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, yes, they do.
They do have a casino. Where is that located? Is it on the reservation itself?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, yes.
Okay. They do pay in lieu of taxes to the county for certain services, is that correct? Schools?
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, in the situation in Grand Ronde, yes, we do contribute to the Spirit Mountain Community Fund, which essentially puts 6% of net revenue, gaming revenue, back into an 11-county service area to provide for education, health, the arts, problem gambling, other programs like that. We also, in Grand Ronde, employ six FTE in a Polk County Sheriff substation on the reservation, and again, our clinic serves the entire community within a 35-mile radius.
Could I follow up, please?
Yes.
That's what I was getting at. I was going to work my way there. Now, is there an intertribal funding mechanism available among tribes? So if one area of the state, one tribe has a particular need, that funds can move back and forth. Is that something that you currently do?
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, with respect to what? Economic development or health?
With respect to health, health care. So if there's a problem in the Warm Springs area and they're not able to fund within on tribal land, public health, for instance, or their health, for instance, is there any precedent for funds coming from another area, such as Grand Ronde, to subsidize what they need in that?
Thank you for the question. The way that tribes typically receive funds, there's a contract through the Indian Health Service. Mm-hmm. There is a formula for distribution per capita. And so the central office of the Indian Health Service has the responsibility of allocating funds per capita. So it's based on how many members you have. No one gets any more than anyone else. So,
what I would, oh, do you want to follow?
Well, I guess I was talking about the state of Oregon and the services that the state of Oregon provide, which tribes do have access to as citizens of the state or members of the state of Oregon. If they live in an urban area, they, you know, a tribe without boundaries, they don't. So you don't have access. Now, I guess what I was getting at is within the state, does the tribal council provide assistance to tribes who do not have the same economic base? Is there any assistance provided on a regular basis?
There is not. There's a Northwest Portland Area Indian Health Board that's located in Portland that addresses educational health promotion type needs, but not a direct health care delivery service. As far as the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde, we are also what you call a federally designated health clinic. So we already have that designation. I don't know if the other 8 tribes of Oregon have that, but that also puts you in a position where you can receive these funds directly that we're talking about. However, those funds are funneled through the state. So, but your question, do we share healthcare dollars? Yeah. We do provide services to any Native American that's in our area.
So one final thought. So the tribes of Oregon have never really come together as a unit statewide to talk about the needs of the individual members of the various tribes and how support can flow back and forth to the tribes that are fairly well off, relatively speaking, to those who have practically nothing.
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, I believe tribes have come together, and they've come together in a couple of ways. One, through the state's government-to-government process, and the wonderful bill that the members of this committee helped pass in 2001 to discuss health issues and health needs. Specific to your question, I guess I would ask another question. How does the public health system work in terms of, say, Multnomah County versus Jackson County? Are certain counties that way, county governments funneling dollars to other counties in the state?
I don't know the answer to that. But I think, again, we need to look at this in the terms of government and tribal governments throughout the state. But, again, we have commented and worked together through the government-to-government process, which, if I may say in closing, Madam Chair, has been one of a true spirit of government-to-government, and Oregon can be proud of the model. And you guys and the policies that you have made can be very proud of the things that we have done. Deletion of squaw language from the Oregon Geographic Board names. Articles relating to illegally held archaeological objects. Creating a Native American teaching certificate. The creation of the Commission on Indian Services under Governor Attia. Oregon has a proud history of dealing in state-tribal relations. We feel that both Senate Bill 855 as well as Senate Bill 967 would continue that proud tradition in looking at health care, not in that us or them mentality, but beyond the boundaries of reservations, and how can we provide the best service for Oregonians?
What I'd like to do is, if there could be a work group with Gary Weeks and Chloe, Ms. Fleming, and Mason, and Justin, and Ms. Kennedy, to come to some sense of agreement, or at least be aware of the problem. And I don't plan to move this, and I will just wait to hear back from those members of the committee. All right? Thank you.
Thank you.
I would like to close Senate Bill 855 and close Senate Bill 967 and open Senate Bill 689. And I'd like to call Senator Victory Walker and Representative Diane Rosenbaum.
Pretty well.
Madam Chair, I'm Vicki Walker, State Senator, District 7, and seated to my left is my good friend and former co-chair of the Oregon Women's Health and Wellness Alliance, Representative Diane Rosenbaum. I asked Diane to co-chief sponsor Senate Bill 689 with me because we were just the past co-chairs of the Women's Health and Wellness Alliance, and we did a lot of good things with that alliance because that alliance is a really great collaboration of public and private folks and organizations that work on behalf of issues pertinent to women and children. And specifically, I also belong to Women in Government, which is an organization that was created in 1988, I believe. And that organization is a group of women state legislators, and we work on issues all across the country related to issues pertinent to women. The Women in Government organization in January of this year launched a nationwide effort to eliminate cervical cancer. They issued a call to action, The State of Cervical Cancer Prevention in America, and issued a report showing how the states were doing. Oregon, I believe, scored a C grade. We weren't doing very well. This is a landmark program. Various women in our organization across the country have introduced legislation to create task forces and address this area of cancer that is highly preventable. According to the department, in their own testimony that they'll be submitting, there were 43 women who died in 2003 of cervical cancer. This is a disease that is highly preventable. We're not willing to sit around and wait anymore for us to try to prevent that disease. So what we wanted to do was create a task force. Now, I have to be the first to admit that I don't really like too many task forces because sometimes they just are a lot of fluff and they don't do much and they spend money. But this is not fluff. And I'm going to be guilty. This is my one and only task force that I've sponsored this session. I think this, as I indicated, in the United States, there are about 12,200 cases of cervical cancer a year and 4,100 deaths annually. Now, I indicated that we had 43 in Oregon last year. These are preventable cancers. This is one cancer that we can prevent. The human papillomavirus is the most common way that women contract this cancer, and early detection. And this virus lays dormant for a number of years, and there are now FDA-approved drugs where we can administer to women, we can do testing and make sure that women are not harboring this virus. And we can also encourage regular pap smears and regular screening. We find that typically in the low-income population, there is not enough encouragement to get them into the doctor for regular screening, and these women succumb to this disease that is entirely preventable. So, Madam Chair and members of the committee, we asked for this task force. Lo and behold, I was given a copy of testimony this morning that the department put together, and I was pulled off the Senate floor by a representative of the American Cancer Society who waved a draft report in front of me but would not share it with me, only showed me the one page related to cervical cancer. But apparently the Department of Human Services has put together a group, and they have some comprehensive cancer control plan that they hope to have in place by June. I was not aware of that. My bill's been introduced since early in the session. Our bill has been introduced, and we are just now hearing about that this morning. I actually, frankly, to tell you the truth, I resent that. I appreciate that the department has done something good here, but I resent finding out this morning that there's some group that's been working on preventing cancer, and I'm just now learning about it. I think given that situation, I need some time to speak with the department about how their cancer control plan fits in with this task force, because if it's one thing that I don't like doing in this process, Madam Chair, it's wasting people's time. And if this is actually something they're going to do, then this is a waste of time. If it's not, then let's work on this and eradicate cervical cancer. And that's my goal, and I believe that's what Representative Rosenbaum will tell you right now. Thank you.
Thank you. Madam Chair, member of the committee, I'm Diane Rosenbaum, representing House District 42 in Southeast and Northeast Portland, and I'm very happy to appear today with Senator Walker in support of Senate Bill 689. I was quite pleased when she asked me to co-sponsor the bill with her. I believe that this is a session where we can make great strides and progress in women's health care, and in fact, on the House side, we have already passed a couple of bills which may, in fact, be in your committee. If they haven't arrived here yet, I'm sure they will be soon, that deal with annual women's health exams and clinical breast exams. And so Senate Bill 689 fits very nicely into what we're trying to do. As Senator Walker's has already stated, we lost 43 women in Oregon to cervical cancer last year, and that really is a startling and unnecessary statistic because, as she also said, we know that this cancer is one of the preventable cancers, and the more we learn about that, the more we realize that there are things that women themselves can do by getting good medical care, by early detection, and actually now appearing even to be some steps that you will hear about shortly in terms of prevention of this cancer, which are make it very exciting. So I, too, hope that we can work with the department, build on any work that has already been done. We certainly are not trying to duplicate things that are going on, but we feel it's extremely important to shed light on this particular condition and the things that can be done to prevent and screen for and cure it, because lives are at stake, and that is something that all Oregon women and their families will benefit from. So I thank you very much for scheduling a hearing today, and to look forward to working with you on this important bill.
Great. Madam Chair, could I add just a couple of comments? I just wanted to alert you that Hispanic women are twice as likely to be diagnosed with cervical cancer as Caucasian women. And one of the hearings that I've had in my education committee was a discussion about the changing population in Oregon and the increasing Latino population in our state is the fastest growing segment of our population. And so here we have studies that show that Hispanic women are twice as likely to be diagnosed with this disease. Approximately half of all cervical cancer cases are in women who have never been screened. never been screened at all, and 10% are in women who have not been screened in the last 5 years. So despite the high level of preventive care that we offer in our country, we see that women are still contracting this disease. And as I indicated, there is a new DNA test for the high-risk HPV or human papillomavirus, and that has been approved for by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration for women 30 and older. So it's a matter of getting education out there, getting women in to see their doctors and having these tests and making sure they get regularly screened.
Discussion? Thank you very much. Marcia Keith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Marcia Keith, and I'm here today representing Merck and Company to speak in support of Senate Bill 689. I also received a copy earlier of the testimony coming from the Department of Human Services, and I read that after I wrote my own testimony, so I will vary somewhat from the written remarks. The point and the main emphasis that I want to make on behalf of Merck and Company is that cervical cancer is very treatable and very preventable, and that we probably ought to be doing a better job of both in the state of Oregon. This task force and the way it is it's laid out in the bill with its goals and objectives and missions seems to us to be a wonderful step in the right direction. If, in fact, it duplicates efforts that are already going on, then we're clearly not in favor of duplication of effort. If it dovetails nicely with some efforts that are currently going on, we would like to see consideration given to the formulation of this task force. I am a member of the Oregon Partnership for Cancer Control on behalf of Merck, and I know that cervical cancer is one of its, the elimination of cervical cancer is one of its 17 goals, and I appreciate that and endorse it, and it's one of the reasons that I'm a member of that group. It seems to me that we could be doing a better job in Oregon of eliminating a cancer that could be so easily eliminated. The last figures I had were from 2002. We had 151 cases of cervical cancer in Oregon. No, I'm sorry, we had 142 cases in the state of Oregon, and we had 51 deaths. So that is more than a third of the people diagnosed with cervical cancer who died from it, and those 51 deaths did not need to happen. With that, I will just leave you with saying that we'd love to see Oregon be a big leader in this effort, and we think the establishment of this task force or something very like it would be a big step forward.
Do you want to just stay there while I bring up Jane Moore, just in case, and then I'll open up discussion.
Good afternoon. Excuse me, Chair Mona Sanderson and the rest of the committee. I am Jane Moore. I'm the section manager for the Health Promotion and Chronic Disease Prevention Programs with the Department of Human Services. Those programs include three cancer-related programs. We have the Statewide Cancer Registry, which collects data on all cancer diagnoses in the state. We have a breast and cervical cancer screening program. that provides screening services for both cervical cancer and breast cancer for uninsured and low-income women in Oregon. We screen about 6,000 women a year. And we also have a new program called Comprehensive Cancer, which is the program that has been working on this cancer plan for Oregon. I am here, I'm sorry to say, on behalf of the department to present testimony in opposition to this bill based on the fact that it, as written, would have a fiscal impact that is not included in the governor's recommended budget. However, I very much want to commend the sponsors of the bill, Senator Walker and Representative Rosenbaum, because they are absolutely right. Cervical cancer continues to be a problem in the state of Oregon. We did lose 43 women to cervical cancer in 2003. We are going to have lost women in 2004, though we don't have the numbers for that right now. And no woman in Oregon or any other place in the United States needs to die of cervical cancer. In fact, screening makes it possible to detect precancerous conditions, so no women really should even suffer from invasive cervical cancer if, in fact, screening programs were widely available. So there is additional work that does need to be done. You have heard that the department, in partnership with well over 100 other organizations, has been undertaking a planning process for the last year for all cancers in Oregon, not just cervical cancer. And there have been 17 objectives identified by that group, one of which is the elimination of cervical cancer. When we compared the work that the Oregon Partnership for Cancer Control has done to the things that were mentioned in the bill, there's very close overlap between them, and we would be very happy to work with the senators and this committee to make sure that we address the issues of cervical cancer for women in Oregon. I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you. Could you make available the information you just talked about, make it available to the committee staff so
absolutely
he can share it with
we
the rest of us?
We can do that.
Thank you.
Seeing no further discussion, since the sponsors of the bill just found out about the work group, I think it really is only appropriate for the two, Jane, Ms. Moore and Senator Walker and Rosenbaum, to talk together to see if the bill is needed, and I would like to have you get back with me then. All right? Thank you.
Thank you.
That's all the testimony. Oh, yes.
Yeah. I guess I'm interested in the bigger picture. You mentioned that there are 17 different cancers that you're looking at. Is that what you described? Could you describe that one more time?
Yes. Chair Mona Sanderson, Senator Morissette, there are 17 overall objectives to the cancer plan. Not every one of them relates to a separate cancer.
Okay.
We'd be very happy to share with the committee.
Okay. You deal with a number of different cancers, though, is that correct?
Yes. There are a number of cancers that are mentioned in the plan.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 689 and open the public hearing on Senate Bill 823. Senator Frank Shields. Okay. I will also open a public hearing on Senate Bill 824, so you can do both, Senator Shields.
That's okay. I can stick around or come back and whatever later. It wouldn't bother me whichever way you want to do things. 824. Chairman Sanderson, committee members. Again, my name is Frank Shields. I represent District 24. I'm going to share some testimony. I think you're probably getting it in writing. It's fairly long, but I'd like you to bear with me in this testimony. We researched it,
and have put a lot of energy into it, and I think it has some significant data that I hope that you'll listen to. I introduced SB 823 with the single goal of limiting or eliminating fetuses, infants, and children's exposure to mercury by removing all but trace amounts of thimerosal, a 50% ethanol mercury-based preservative used in vaccines. We remove any doubt that we are unnecessarily exposing fetuses and infants to potentially life-altering amounts of this neurotoxin. I use the term unnecessary because it is widely recognized that viable alternatives exist to create sterile vaccines. This proposed legislation is part of a national movement. I underscore that. It isn't something that we're doing by ourselves. It's occurring at both the federal and state level. In 1999, listen to this, the U.S. FDA, the Public Health Service, and the American Academy of Pediatrics all recommended the removal of thimerosal from childhood vaccines. This was in reaction to the fact that an aggressive immunization schedule set in the 90s exposed children to the cumulative doses of mercury far above EPA standards. I'm sure you recognize what that means is that it might not be just one shot, but you have cumulative shots and it accumulates in the system. At the national level, U.S. Representative Dave Weldon, who's a Republican from Florida, a physician, has introduced the Mercury Free Vaccines Act of 2005, mandating a phased elimination of mercury in vaccines. Similarly, at least 12 other states have related pending legislation. Last year, both California and Iowa passed legislation similar to Senate Bill 823, mandating that vaccines contain only trace amounts of thimerosal. In signing Assembly Bill 2943 into law, Governor Schwarzenegger stated that while he was unconvinced of the direct link between thimerosal and neurodevelopmental diseases, he said, an abundance of caution merits the acceleration of a process already underway to remove thimerosal from the last few vaccines that contain it. It's a cautionary approach. This legislative body demonstrated that same abundance of caution in 2001 when we passed SB 482, mandating that DHS purchase and distribute thimerosal-free vaccines when commercially available. I should have said quote-unquote, I suppose. Senate Bill 823 builds upon this recognition of potential harm and ensures that we continue to move toward a thimerosal-free, toxics-free vaccines for fetuses and children. This bill requires that all vaccines administered to children under the age of 3 and to pregnant mothers are free or contain only trace amounts. This measure allows the flexibility to administer vaccines that exceed this amount in the case of emergency, as declared by the governor and the public health officer. So there is a factor to take account of any major health contingencies that we don't think about. And this is important, too. The provisions do not take effect until January 2007, allowing the necessary time for manufacturers to react to the demand for thimerosal-free vaccines. The only company, and that's the Pasteur company referred to in my testimony, licensed by the FDA to manufacture the flu vaccine for children as young as 6 to 24 months has stated that they believe that they can produce a sufficient amount, listen to this, a sufficient amount of mercury-free vaccine, providing they're notified early enough. So by passing this, we give them plenty of time as well. The concern posed by the current influenza vaccine shortage is thus addressed both by this extended implementation timeline and a slightly higher tolerance level for thimerosal because the governor could declare that emergency or the health officer could do so. I'm also open to considering an amendment that allows for an exemption by the public health officer if a vaccine shortage is quote-unquote deemed imminent. There is much we do not know about the intricacies of thimerosal and its impact on the developmental processes of children. All I know is the the children I've seen, and I'm going to get to that in a little bit. Based on recent epidemiological study by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the Institute of Medicine, they concluded that there was no causal link between thimerosal and autism. But here I must highlight that the finding no evidence of a causal link does not rule out thimerosal's role as an aggravating factor, nor does it deem it safe. Scientists, including the noted expert Boyd Haley, chairman of the chemistry department at the University of Kentucky, and neuropharmacologist Richard Deth, D-E-T-H, continue to raise concerns about mercury-laced vaccines. Given ongoing research, the lack of in-depth knowledge about thimerosal's biological interactions, and prevalent case studies which link inoculations with late onset regressive autism and other disorders, I suggest, colleagues, that we must proceed with the utmost caution. During my tenure in this legislature, and I was elected the first time in 1992, we have seen, and I'm serious about this, an epidemic rise in neurodevelopmental disorders ranging from ADHD to autism. Autism rates in the United States increased from about 1 in 2,500, this is startling to me, to 1 in the 70s, to 1 in 250 today. The cost of these afflictions is placed on individuals, on families, on our state and our nation, and they're immense. This discussion of mercury and vaccine does not occur in a vacuum. A recent study conducted by the EPA revises estimates of U.S. children born annually who are exposed to unsafe mercury levels to double previous estimates, totaling 1 in 6, or roughly 630,000 infants per year. Additionally, studies suggest that particular individuals are exponentially more sensitive to the damaging effects of mercury, a factor that uniform vaccine schedules do not take into account. Let's stop and think about that for a minute. I ask this committee to uphold the precautionary principle, which advises that when in doubt, and in this case there is doubt in the scientific and the wider community, take an action which minimizes the risk of harm. In this case, thimerosal-free vaccines are a policy choice which, at only the cost of a couple dollars per vaccination, removes any question of harm. I want to thank you for your time. I realize I was trying to deal with a lot of huge words. I'm not good at that. I do want you to know, Senator Anderson, Montes Anderson, that this morning I kept saying, I'm going to come over and talk to that woman just as soon as we get done with the bill that you were carrying. Of course, we got done with the bill that you were carrying at the end of the morning session. What I wanted to do when I came over was talk to you a little bit about my testimony before I got here, but also indicate that there are people in the audience who've traveled a considerable distance who have an awful lot more expertise than I do on this bill, so I hope you'll give them a hearing.
That's right. And Senator Shields, we may not get to Senate Bill 824 today.
That's fine.
And I want members of the audience to realize that unless there's someone that really came a long distance, and I will definitely want to make sure that you are able. So would you please let staff know if you made a long trip for Senate Bill 824, and I will squeeze you in.
I'll be glad to come back on 824 at another time. I do hope that if somebody's come more than 100 miles or something, you'll just open a brief hearing for them.
Okay.
I'm going to stick around a little bit to listen to some of this testimony from experts.
Are there
any questions, or can I speak back?
It's Dr. Woody McGinnis and Dr. Edelson, I think.
Edelson.
Is it Steve?
Yes, Steve.
Okay.
Thank you.
Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee. I am Woody R. McGinnis from Ashland. I began practicing general medicine in Tucson, Arizona in 1977, and 11 years ago I started learning about biochemical and nutritional interventions for children with neurobehavioral disorders such as autism and ADHD. My initial interest in this area stemmed directly from the behavioral problems of my own son, Ryan, so I'm coming to you as a parent as well. As I learned about these children, a very clear pattern of underlying physical illness emerged. As a group, children with behavioral disorders have suboptimal levels of many important nutrients, as well as significantly higher toxin levels. Most of the children I saw responded with significant improvements in behavior when their biochemical problems were addressed. I became engrossed in the relevant nutrition, biochemistry, and toxicology. Many other physicians are making similar observations, and this is building a great mass of clinical knowledge about the physical determinants of abnormal behavior. This clinical knowledge has not been well integrated into mainstream science with enough formal research and publication. 4 years ago, I decided to suspend active practice and to devote myself to full-time research. I conceptualize and coordinate the Oxidative Stress and Autism Study, a multi-university project funded by private sources and the National Institutes of Health. The initial results of this study will be presented in June at an international symposium, which I organized at the New York State Institute for Basic Research in Developmental Disabilities. For the committee record, I submit the published articles which have evolved from this new phase in my career, as well as my curriculum vitae. I think you will agree that my past experience and current pursuits are relevant to questions about mercury toxicity, which is central to Senate Bill 823. Senate Bill 823 seeks to reduce exposure of developing fetuses, infants, and young children to thimerosal, which is chemically ethyl mercury, a preservative used in many vaccines to prevent bacterial contamination. This bill is meritorious because we are by no means sure that thimerosal is safe for use in vaccines. It is certain that credible thimerosal safety studies have never been performed. Thimerosal in vaccines is a vestige of old-fashioned 1930s vaccine technology. The habitual use of thimerosal continued through the decades as we were learning about some very grave lessons having to do with the neurotoxicity of other mercurial compounds. In the first half of the 20th century, pink disease claimed the brains and lives of thousands of children before science finally deduced that the cause was mercurous chloride in the teething powders that they were using for fussy babies. In the second half of the century, methylmercury food contamination in Japan and Iraq caused mental retardation, cerebral palsy, and visual and auditory deficits in children of exposed mothers. Lower levels of exposure to methylmercury produced more subtle effects, such as developmental delays. During this time, hardly anyone did much thinking about thimerosal, which was seeing use in an increasing number of vaccines. The legislative process helped alert science to the potential health risks of thimerosal. Several years ago, the United States Congress enacted legislation which required tabulation and quantification of mercury in consumer products for the first time. Over 200 products made the list. Mercury, in the form of thimerosal, was seemingly everywhere. Vaccines, contact lens solutions, hemorrhoidal creams, a topical antiseptic called methylate or mercurochrome. Thimerosal poses under some 50 different aliases. As a direct result of this tabulation, science also began to appreciate the microgram quantities of organic mercury delivered by injection in the form of thimerosal in vaccines. The microgram per kilogram doses of mercury as thimerosal in these vaccines shocked some of our top vaccinologists, such as Neil Halsey from Johns Hopkins. He had admitted a few years ago that the experts had just never done the calculations, which suggested many infants were actually getting vaccine doses of mercury in excess of EPA standards for total exposure. For instance, and I depart from my written text here, but Merck was the first and best in reacting immediately to the possible problem of a thimerosal in these vaccines. The Merck Heptavax, the hepatitis B vaccine, which is given on the day of birth, say to a 7-pound infant, which is 3 kilograms, contained 12.5 milligrams or micrograms of mercury as in the form of thimerosal. That child, by EPA standards, should not be receiving more than 0.3, but was received micrograms on any given day, but received 12.5. Well, mercury acted very conscientiously to that new knowledge. A 22-pound child who at 6 months is receiving his first influenza vaccine should not be getting more than 1 microgram per day of mercury from all sources, but gets 25 milligrams according to the DHS figures with each of the influenza vaccines. As science knows a lot more about the neurotoxicity of methylmercury than thimerosal, but the two are very similar structurally. Over the years, studies have demonstrated measurable effects from smaller and smaller doses of methylmercury. This has resulted in recent warnings by the FDA limiting fish consumption by women and children due to methylmercury bioaccumulation. We do not know the lowest dose of methylmercury which impairs neurodevelopment. And neurodevelopment is not limited to gestation, but of course progresses rapidly and profoundly after birth. When my colleagues and I approached the FDA a few years ago to express concern about the structural similarity of this methylmercury, which is known toxic, and thimerosal, we were told by the FDA that there just was not any evidence that thimerosal was neurotoxic. While we still don't know if thimerosal at relevant doses is neurotoxic in humans, a study last year by Dr. Mady Hornig of Columbia University demonstrated for the first time that weight-adjusted doses of thimerosal equivalent to the infant vaccine schedule produced profound brain damage and behavioral changes in experimental animals. And I've submitted that article for the record. Interestingly, sensitivity to thimerosal in the Hornig study depended on the strain of animal tested. Some animals of the same species were sensitive to thimerosal and some were not. There is an important parallel to consider in human subjects. Dr. Vera Staeskal of the Karolinska Institute of Stockholm has published a series of articles demonstrating that the cells of some persons are as much as 1 million times more sensitive to the toxic effect of mercury than the cells of other persons. Put simply, some individuals are particularly sensitive to mercury while others are not. This extreme variability in sensitivity to mercury questions the various assumption that there is any safe dose for thimerosal in vaccines, at least for the most sensitive individuals. Research in this field is really nascent. But there exists preliminary data suggesting that children with autism may comprise one such group of thimerosal-sensitive individuals. For the record, I have submitted relevant articles by Dr. Mark Geyer and Dr. Jill James. Last year, the Institute of Medicine, the IOM, concluded that no evidence exists for neurotoxicity in humans from thimerosal in vaccines. This represented a shift away from a previous IOM announcement, which considered a link to autism, quote, medically plausible. The more recent IOM position was shaped by an intervening epidemiologic study by the Centers for Disease Control. The CDC study failed to demonstrate any association between thimerosal in vaccines and neurobehavioral disorders. Conversely, the previously cited study by Geyer, which I've submitted to the committee, did find a strong association between thimerosal-containing vaccines and several neurobehavioral disorders, including mental retardation, autism, speech disorder, and personality disorder. I would ask you, as fair-minded individuals, to consider this discrepancy in results and how it may owe to a fundamental methodologic error in the CDC study. The CDC only included healthy infants, excluding the large subset of less robust infants with jaundice, low birth weight, prematurity, infection, and the like. So this CDC study it was science at the highest government levels, but it was not sound. Science well knows that in toxicologic terms, the weakened organism is usually more sensitive. and children in suboptimal health had ought to have been included in that study. I hope my testimony has helped you see some of the facts which suggest that thimerosal represents a neurotoxicologic health risk to humans. Currently, all of the thimerosal-containing vaccines during pregnancy for Rh negativity, hepatitis B as early as the day of birth, diphtheria, pertussis, tetanus, and H flu starting at 2 months, influenza vaccine to pregnant mothers, and now for babies at 6, 7, and 12 to 24 months, are all available as thimerosal-free preparations, the supply of which is increasing with demand as would be expected. Thimerosal in vaccines has entered the realm of strong scientific doubt. We just do not know for sure about thimerosal. Since the stakes are very great and an alternative exists, logic favors a conservative approach to the use of thimerosal in vaccines. Iowa and California recently have enacted similar laws in an abundance of caution, and I strongly urge your support and consideration of SB 823. Thank you kindly.
Thank you so much for coming, Dr. McGinnis. Just for the record, there are two people, I think, that took time off from work that came to testify on Senate Bill 824. I just want to know if they would be able to come at another time. Otherwise, we have 10 minutes left before we need to leave this room. Gary Cobb and
Christine
Jurison?
Jameson.
I'd love to get a chance to give you my story why I support 824.
Okay. And how about you? Okay. We have 10 minutes.
I'll try it in five.
All right. Go for it, Dr. Edelson.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Steve Edelson. I'm a research psychologist. I've been studying causes and treatments of autism for 27 years. I'm the past president of the Autism Society of Oregon. I currently serve on its board of directors. I'm also one of 30 members of the Autism Society of America's Professional Advisory Board. I'm the only representative in the Northwest. I also teach across the street as an as-needed basis, and one of my courses on autism is probably the most popular one in the psychology department. As an expert on the field of autism, I have been following the research on mercury and its association with autism for many years. At first, I was quite skeptical, since I believe and still believe that vaccines are very important for public health. My own children have been vaccinated. However, over the past 5 years, it has become obvious that there is a relationship between mercury and neurodevelopmental disorders, including autism. As you may or may not be aware, the Center for Disease Control, which both promotes and oversees the use of vaccines, has publicly stated that there is no relationship between neurodevelopmental disorders and vaccines. However, the CDC's own researchers have revealed clear relationships between vaccines and neurodevelopmental disorders. These findings, as well as closed-door discussions, have been obtained using the Freedom of Information Act. Basically, the greater amount of thimerosal exposure, the greater the risk of developing neurodevelopmental disorders. I've included Appendix A and Appendix B, which clearly states their positions. Since my area of study is autism, I would like to address the autism-mercury connection by raising questions often raised by critics who claim there is no such relationship. The so-called epidemic is simply due to improved diagnosis and awareness. The state of California spends a great deal of effort and money to determine the true prevalence of autism. According to their data, the rate of autism began in the mid-1980s. At that time, the rate of autism was 1 in 2,000. And this prevalence rate has been estimated since the early 70s. The estimated rate of autism today, according to the CDC, is 1 in 166. The California regional centers are in charge of diagnosing autism. In order for these children to receive services, they have not changed their method of diagnosis since 1971. Another criticism, since autism is genetic, there cannot be a relationship between autism and vaccines. Researchers have been discussing since the 70s and began searching in the 1980s for the autism gene. They are in agreement that somewhere between 5 and 12 or possibly more genes are involved in autism. They acknowledge that there is a genetic predisposition, and in many, they feel that there is some trigger in the environment. In addition, with respect to this genetic issue, there is no such thing as a genetic epidemic. Genetic diseases increase approximately 1% per 100 years. Another criticism, since thimerosal has been used in drugs since the 1930s, why did the increase in autism begin 50 years later? Researcher Mark Blaxill has graphed the amount of mercury thimerosal exposure in relationship to the prevalence of autism. His results show a perfect relationship between the amount of thimerosal used in vaccines and the increase in autism. And it's in, the graph is in Appendix C. Another question, which was raised in NBC's one-week series on autism just a few weeks ago, and they answered it incorrectly. Basically, since the drug companies began to eliminate or reduce the amount of thimerosal in their vaccines as a result of the FDA's 1999 request, shouldn't there be a decrease in autism a few years later? The average age of diagnosis of autism is 4 years. One would expect to see a decrease starting in 2003-2004. That is what has happened in California. And I've got a graph in Appendix D. If thimerosal and vaccines are associated with autism,
we need to.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Could you sum up this, since we have all of this in writing? Maybe
okay.
Sum up.
Okay. Well, basically, the way I see it, based on my conversation with many people involved in this issue, single vial thimerosal-free vaccines would cost just a few dollars. This is a very small amount, given the lifelong potential harm it can cause. I'd like to conclude that by saying mercury is highly neurotoxic, mercury in any amount should not be given to anyone, especially pregnant women and young children.
Thank you so much for your time. I would like to have a ask, is Catherine Badley, do you have written testimony? Do you want to submit that, and we will put that into the record in case we don't have time, because I'm going to open another so that the two who came gave up work to come.
Sure.
Could you come to the? Yeah, we would. If we decide to do that, then what we will do is bring it back to discuss the amendment. Okay. So if you could submit your testimony, and I will go through that. And okay. Thank you very much. Oh, Senator Morse.
Is there a better diagnosis of autism today? Are they finding? Is that part of the increase incidence?
Not really.
Well, you don't have to go into detail.
Just one couple sentences. California is the state we rely on for prevalence rates. Mm-hmm. They have not changed the way they diagnose their children since 1971.
Good. Thank you.
Okay, I'm not going to close this just in case we have enough time, but I would like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 824 and ask Gary Cobb to come up. And Christine Jameson to give your story on that on your bill, and then we will be hearing this bill later, but you won't have to come back. Gary Cobb.
Members of the committee, my name is Christy Jameson, and just with respect to the time frame you outlined, I'd like to save my testimony until the bill is reopened again.
Oh, thank you very much.
Gary.
Okay.
Hi, my name is Gary Cobb. I'm a member with the Recovery Association Project, and I want to thank you, Madam Chair, committee members, for extending this time to let me testify on this important bill. The reason why it's important to me and many others to do away with the premiums is of the for people at
this. I should have Mr. Bacobian summarize Senate Bill 824.
Thanks.
Well, just briefly, Senator, this bill does waive the premiums. Right now, anybody in the Oregon Health Plan standard population must pay a premium regardless of where they're at in the federal poverty level. The bill would waive that for clients in that 11% who are up to 11% of the federal poverty level.
Okay, thank you. I was 4.5 years ago, I was one of those individuals that was at that 0 to 10% of the FPL, and my premiums were waived for me. That allowed me to engage in the chemical dependency treatment, the mental health treatment, and the treatment to address my hepatitis C and some other health issues that I had going on at the time. Today, 4.5 years later, I'm still clean. My mental health has stabilized. My hepatitis C is in check. And I'm also allowed to be gainfully employed. And so what you get when you waive premiums for individuals, you get money coming back into our general fund. I can read down the list of the $30 every week that I pay back into our state's general fund, and I'm grateful to do that. I'm very grateful that I had an opportunity to get my premiums waived. It's an investment. It does indeed work, and I think it's something that we all should look at with this methamphetamine epidemic that's going on. Give people the opportunity to utilize and get their health back on track. It does indeed work, and, you know, people do recover. You've seen me, I don't know, I've testified in several times in front of half the members here, and I would have had this room packed with a busload of people, but the hearing got changed on us, and next time I will have more people in here backing what I'm saying. And I'd love to answer any questions if you guys want to ask me anything in regards to this.
Thank you, Mr. Cobb, for your story.
Thank you.
And we will be hearing this bill probably next week, but I'm not quite sure yet.
Maybe we can get GEICO to start doing health insurance, huh?
Okay, then I will close the public hearing on 824, and we'll bring up Catherine Bradley real quick.
Did you hear that other lady?
Since the next administrator is breathing down our necks. Okay, while she's getting ready, Dr. Lacey, James Lacey from Salem, submitted testimony regarding prohibiting the use of mercury in pediatric vaccines and for pregnant women, and he is in favor. So if you could add that to yours. Thank you. Bradley.
Thank you. Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee, my name is Catherine Bradley, and I'm the administrator for the Office of Family Health, Department of Human Services. We are offering amendment to Senator Shields' bill, and we have been in contact with his office in this discussion. It is specifically related to flu immunization, and it requests an exemption for vaccines and injectable products containing mercury by pregnant women and children under 3 years of age. I'm going to skip the first or second paragraph and move down a little bit further. The proposed amendment exempts flu vaccine from Senate Bill 823. This exemption is requested because for the next several years, it is anticipated there will be a very limited supply of mercury-free influenza vaccine for pregnant women and children under 3 years of age. Currently, there are only two manufacturers with FDA approval for flu vaccines, and they are not able to manufacture large enough quantities to meet demand. Other manufacturers are applying for FDA approval, but it's a long process. I mentioned in testimony to see the attached chart. Unfortunately, the chart is not a part of this, but I will have it in the committee's hands in the next couple of days. The bottom line on that is that there's approximately 100 million doses of flu that are going to be required for the upcoming flu season that is particular to this population group of pregnant and young children, and we are probably about a third short, and the manufacturers have notified us that they do not anticipate being able to meet that entire need. So what we're requesting, actually, is that there is an exemption at this point in time so that we will be able to address the upcoming flu season and not be caught in a situation of only having thimerosal-free flu vaccine and have mothers that are pregnant women and young children under the ages of 3 at risk because of it.
And which is worse? We don't really know the effects of thimerosal. I mean, the study, at least what the previous testimony was.
Right.
So it's interesting. Are the effects of flu going to be far worse than
right.
possible reaction to thimerosal?
Chair Mona Sanderson, I appreciate your question because that really is the crux of what we're struggling with as a public health debate. I actually do have with me here today Dr. Paul Cieslak, who is the manager of the Communicable Disease Program, who can speak to the thimerosal concerns from our perspective, and he's spoken to this committee before. It is our judgment at this time that it is a very low-level risk of thimerosal for one or two doses over the next 2 years while we're still dealing with a shortage issue over a lifetime of mercury that might be accumulated, that the public health risk of illness and possible death to pregnant women and young children is a very real concern, and that's why we're offering this as an amendment. There is an opportunity within the bill for there actually to be considered to be a vaccine education and prioritization plan so that we can go into an emergency prevention mode for flu shortage, which is what we did this last year. But we are hesitant to really sort of anticipate that and do that when that would really require the state of Portland and all Oregonians to go under a shortage plan if at this time what we're looking at is a small subsection.
The state of Portland, very interesting.
Sorry. My apologies.
No, that's actually appropriate. I guess I was wondering, Madam Chair, we've already passed a bill on this issue. What was lacking in that bill that we've already passed?
The bill that I'm speaking to right now is Bill 823.
I understand that, but we've already passed a bill dealing with thimerosal, and I thought we had general consensus that dealt with the issue. So, and I'm Dr. Cieslak seems to be.
What, since we need to since we need to get out of the room, what I would like is if you and Dr. Cieslak could check with where our bill is on the House side, and if there's anything that can come from this bill to add to the bill on the House side, if our bill is going to be heard, that would be interesting to work on rather than have another bill like this coming out. But let's work with Senator Shields on that. Okay?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I'd like to close the public hearing on 823. And did I close the public hearing on, well, I'll close it again on 824. And the meeting's adjourned.